Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Atlantic Bushcraft Adventures. Tonight we are on episode 240. And yes, 240 is correct. You may have noticed that like last week I might have said 238, that or 239. No, last week I would have said 238 because I thought this week was 239. Going back through and uploading stuff to the audio side of things, I realized we actually did episode 237 twice. So everything has now been updated, and hopefully we're all caught back up for our listeners out there. No, you weren't having an aneurysm. I screwed up, as is usually the case. But anyway, episode 240. This is your topic here tonight, and we're talking about the perfect escape, Ben. So why don't you lead us in, buddy?
Yeah. So the gist of this, and although we're not like a prepper or survival type channel, the preface of this was, if you had to make like an escape, a bug out type thing, and you had to choose the perfect kind of location, and we're not giving coordinates or anything, we're going to talk about what you would look for.
Theoreticals and hypotheticals.
Yeah, to make probably the most ideal situation possible. And I think there's a lot to this subject. So this could go a little ways, but no, we don't want to make it too long, so we're going to hit the highlights. But what if the goal is to get you thinking about, you know, some kind of locations and what we would do.
All right, Ben, give me 1 second. Just close my office door.
Run with. So we're going to talk a little bit about probably environment, resources, and even to some degree weather. So, you know, if you're perfect location isn't a place that you just can't survive at, then it's not perfect. So I think those are probably the big things, is what natural resources are available, what's the environmental situation, what's the terrain like, and what the food situation is. Like, you know, so there's a lot to this, and there's a few things that I would probably generally look for, because I think those would give me access to the maximum amount of resources that I could get.
Well, I mean, right off top of my head, let's talk about the elephant in the room. Number one thing that I'm going to look for in any situation, bug out or otherwise, and I'm sure you're going to be on the same page as this one, Ben, water. Has to be some sort of water source nearby. And I would prefer a flowing water source personally, something like a river, something like that. That allows a few extra things down the road, which we may or may not chat about. But anyway, that's something major for me, is there has to be a steady supply of water, preferably moving water, a small river or something like that. I could probably do with a stream, but I would prefer like a larger stream. You know what I mean? I don't want a trickle. I would look for something that has at least enough moving water. If I was going to set up camp, we're talking bug out here, long-term things. First thing that comes to mind is I'm going to make a water wheel at some point. Not going to be the first thing I bang out, of course, but at some point, I'm probably going to look towards either a water wheel or a water hammer to try and cut down on some of the physical effort I got to exert if I'm staying out there a long time. Or just to make things a little nicer. I mean, with a water wheel, you can even make a decent rotisserie, cook a decent turkey in the woods. You know what I mean?
So, I had a similar thought, but I actually kind of had a couple of things I wanted to fit. Water, yes. 100%. I actually would like to make sure that there is water significantly higher than my shelter location. And the reason for that would be that I can pretty well guarantee I'm going to be able to set up water pressure and water volume. So if you can get like a lake that's up on a hill and you're partway up the hill, if you can run a water line from that hill, that lake, to your house, and say you got 50, 60, 100 feet difference between you and that lake, then you can get high pressure. Like, you're going to be able
to... Oh, man, you can get amazing pressure. So anybody that doesn't, you know, work with this kind of stuff, start at the lakeside with a bigger pipe and get some reducers so that when you get to where you want to be, you're down to about half inch, 3/4 inch. Same line that would be in your house. I mean, I've seen pressure come out of there that would scare you. A buddy of mine used to live out towards Anakinish in a little camp. And this camp was exclusively run by gravity-fed water. And originally they had a big pipe and it just kind of trickled out, you know what I mean? And they had constant problems with getting water pressure. So Mark decided to go with like a 6 foot at the top. And then he reduced it down to like a 4 inch. And then he reduced it down to a 2-inch, and then just right before it went into the house, it was reduced down to a 1-inch. And I mean, they were actually having problems, and we're talking a pretty good run here, Ben. We're talking like 500-600 meters. You know what I mean? Yeah. Not 500-600 feet. We're talking 500-600 meters. And it was quite the elevation difference. But anyway, once it got to the camp, they were actually having problems with the fittings coming loose when the water was stopped because there was so much pressure built on there. And they actually had to tinker with it a little bit to make it so that they had enough water pressure in the camp to be worth it, but not enough that it was going to blow stuff apart every time they tried to crack a valve open.
Yeah. I was at a cabin recently where they had a similar type problem. So if you can get enough head, the head is the height from the outlet and the inlet. And if you can get enough, I think it's about every 10 meters is an atmosphere or something, or maybe it's less than that.
I don't know the math or science involved.
But the more height you get, the more pressure you're going to get. The size of the pipe has some different effects, but it shouldn't really change pressure too much. But yeah, so that's kind of my thought. And I watched a really cool episode years ago where on BBC, I think it was Planet Mechanics or It's Not Easy Being Green or something like that. And this guy, Daryl Strawbridge, did this on a hiking trail. And they used fire hose, which they hooked up to, I think it was a steel pipe that was dipped into a pond or a pool high up in the river. And they ran it all the way down to this hostel. And they were able to produce enough pressure at the hostel to turn a turbine that provided all the power for the hostel. So this just turned a small electric motor that then pushed power, and it was enough to charge batteries, turn on the LED lights, and various other things they wanted. Plus, it meant that there was always a steady stream of water at the camp in case it was needed. So that's two major things that you can get. Water wheel would be great too. Yeah, but again,
I was going to say, to make a basic turbine, there's instructions on YouTube, of course, and I'm not going to pretend I'm an expert. But I do know old washing machines, if you want higher voltage, or literally the,
Alternator.
Thank you. Alternator of a vehicle will give you a good 12 volt. Actually, it'll give you more than 12 volt, depending if you have a regulated or unregulated alternator. So if you have an unregulated one, depending on how fast it's spinning, it's going to dictate how much voltage you get out of it. Versus if you have a regulated one, it's going to put out a constant, usually around 14.2, somewhere in around there, volts, yeah. Which then you can in turn charge batteries with, like car batteries, and you can use an inverter or stuff off that. So it just depends what you got on hand. I know enough of this stuff to be incredibly dangerous and probably blow myself up.
Yeah, so there are plenty of options you can get out there. Many electric motors can be converted to become generators. You can also just get a generator. Inverters are somewhat accessible these days. And in, you know, charging your batteries means that you can take power from the batteries and power almost everything else. So it's a great way to store up some power and preserve, you know, a lot of luxury that you wouldn't have otherwise. So for me, if I'm looking at long term and I'm going to have to get back somewhere, and if we're talking about it, I don't know what the problem is, why I'm taking off, but I'm assuming that I'm not able to use the grid. I'm avoiding something. So that's very important. So water is essential. Supply of fresh water is essential for a lot of reasons. One, it means that most likely you can grow food. It's not an arid environment, so you probably have trees, forests, things around. Good chance you're going to have access to things like fish and other freshwater things.
And that Steve it was Danny. Danny had mentioned, got to have a fishing spot, and this is the thing. When choosing your water supply, you can kind of get two things handled out there, so just make sure there's fish in the location that you're going. And once again, getting back to the river versus a lake, well, most lakes, they have some sort of inlet, you know what I mean? But when you have free moving water, there's hopefully, and I do say hopefully because you got to do some research here, there's always going to be that renewing of fish as they spawn and stuff like that. So you'll have to learn the tracks or the timing and stuff like that when it's going to be most available. But generally, most rivers here in Nova Scotia anyway, you should be able to get some sort of fish out of them. You may just be getting brookies. You may not be eating like a king, But you're going to have something. And there's a lot of omega-3s and stuff like that in fish, which is essential to you, not only in a survival situation, but if you're trying to stay longevity-wise out in the woods, because there's a lot of fats and stuff in there that your body needs to keep you moving. A lot of people say, oh, I'll just hunt rabbits. Rabbits can actually make you protein sick. You know what I mean? There's no fat on them. So you do have to take in some sort of fat. And fish is a great example of that. Anybody that watches the shows like Alone and things like that, fish is the first thing they look for because it provides you with a lot of good stuff that'll keep you moving in your day-to-day exercises. And when I say exercises, I mean, you know, your tasks and chores and stuff like that.
So I would also like to find something that's close to seawater, saltwater. And the reason for that is it's another environment that I'm going to be able to. So if you can find a stream that's coming out of some high areas, so near mountainous hilly areas and flowing down, where you get that power from the water and then going into an ocean, it means you now have multiple environments from which to pull resources from, because salt water has its own resources. Plus, one of the things that would be the most difficult to produce would, of course, be salt. You know, I heard someone say, if you watch animals, you can figure out where they're getting their salts from. But if you go inland where there's not a ready supply of salt, I mean, you hear of salt licks for animals and stuff. You put it out and it'll attract animals. Animals are good at finding salt. Humans, less so.
And anybody's wondering why salt is important, sorry to cut you off, Ben, but just keep on this before we move on. Keep in mind, folks, salt is not only a spice that, you know, it's a flavor enhancer as a spice. Yes, it tastes salty, but it also enhances the other flavors if added properly. It's also a curing agent. Salt becomes pretty important when you're trying to store meat long-term. You know what I mean? You can salt, dry, and store things for a longer period than if you, say, just harvest a deer and leave it hanging in the tree. That's not going to last that long versus if you harvest a deer, you strip it down, and then you salt the pieces. That's going to last significantly longer. Once again, you're going back to kind of the primitive methods of keeping things running, right? So that's why salt's important. Like, the most important spice of anything that's out there. Mineral, I guess, is not really a spice.
Also, without adequate salt, you will die.
Yes.
So salt is necessary for your brain to work, for everything else to work. Too much salt has its own issues, but having the ability to get the salt. So if you have salt water, you can harvest salt. And the way you would do that, that I'm familiar with, and not that I've done this, is you literally boil the salt water. And as you boil it, it becomes saltier and saltier and saltier. And you can add a little bit of water, and you'll get to a point of basically being super saturated, at which point it'll start to crystallize. And you will have crystallized salt that you can then use for everything else. So salt is obtainable with some pretty rudimentary things, basically a pot and a fire, and you can get salt.
Fair warning, takes a lot of water for a little bit of salt. I have done this at pure curiosity, not with a campfire, actual butane burner. You know what I mean? I was like, I wonder how much water I actually have to boil before I start getting salt. It's a significant amount. Depends on the concentration of salt in the water you're at, right? So if you're in the Dead Sea with the concentrations already high, it's probably going to be significantly less. Around here where I was, I mean, there was a couple rivers that were not far from where I was pitching the salt water out, which means it probably wasn't super strong salt water, if that makes sense. It didn't have a lot of salt in it to begin with. So I had to boil a lot of that down. But still, it's going to take way more than you think. Don't think you're just going to take, like, you know, your little cup like this, boil it off, and have a shaker full of salt. It isn't going to happen. No. You boil that off, you might get, you know, if you're lucky, maybe a pinch of salt. And I mean a pinch. We're talking like a couple grains.
It takes time. And honestly, there are processes to doing it. And once you get it moving to a certain point, it gets a little bit better, but because what you need is basically some salt for the salt to even crystallize too. And so as you start to boil down more and more and you get a concentration, you can get more out of it. But it does take time. It takes effort. But if you're regularly running a fire and you want to boil a couple of gallons of water every night, come in the morning, you will have reached a certain level of proficiency at it. Probably enough to do the bit you need for your personal use. I wouldn't waste good resources like propane or gases for that. You'd want to, you know, be getting it off of something you're already putting effort into anyways.
And that's the secret right there, Ben, is you just keep it running. This is, you're not just going to make salt today. You know what I mean? Like, that may be the main thing you're doing is running water to the salt boiler, but you're not just going to make salt today. This is going to be an ever-going process where it becomes a chore that you have to do pretty much daily. You know what I mean? You're going to keep adding water. You're going to scrape some salt off. Once again, just keep in mind, it is a fair amount of effort and a lot of water you're going to have to boil down. But, as Ben said, salt's important, so it is worth the effort putting it in. And on the side note, if you happen to set up only by the ocean and we're boiling the salt off anyway, or boiling the water off to get salt, depending on what you have available to you, you can basically make a, you know, a redneck still and just redistill the water, and what's going to come off that is going to be clean drinking water. So depending on your situation, something else to keep in mind is not only are you making salt, you're getting some drinking water out of the process too.
Yeah. But every environment, every ecosystem that you can have within, in, let's say, a day's track is an advantage to you. So anywhere you find, you can get a mix. So if you can get a lake environment, maybe a marsh environment, maybe a forest environment and an ocean environment, as well as maybe a river environment, it means that your opportunities for food goes up significantly, and also other resources.
Just answering a comment here, but seeing I'm typing it out, I'll just let you know. Steve looked it up, and Google says 3 teaspoons per liter, but he assumes that's with highly efficient process and no loss. I wasn't getting 3 teaspoons per liter, I can tell you that. So I imagine, I just want to actually finish my thought here. I imagine that's going to depend highly on the concentration of salt in the water that you're with. Again, like I said, I don't have a baseline for where Google got this stuff. For me, it was out of the Marrakesh Harbor, and I know I didn't get that kind of turnaround. But maybe where Google did this here or got their stats, there's a higher concentration of salt. I don't know.
You do, like, if you're close to a mouth or a river entering the ocean, you are going to get more brackish waters in those locations. Mm. You may have to get out of ways to get the full concentration. There are factors, and even I've read this, even like after a heavy rain, the fresh water can actually sit on top for a while, and you'll get fresher water near the top, and you won't get the saltiest water. So, you know, season to season, time to time, there may be a slight variance there. But overall, the average is pretty consistent. So just be aware of that. So it's possible to gain that one spice, or not so much spice, but that one mineral. And the thing is, sea salt actually contains quite a few minerals.
Hmm.
And so sea salt is a pretty healthy salt. So if you have to collect it, you know, it can do a lot for your health. So it's a worth thing. So if you can get fish from freshwater and saltwater, you can get access to seaweeds, because a lot of seaweeds are edible. Research it before you try. So that would be some of the things I look for. The location of my shelter, there's the other thing. Okay, fine. We have the environment, so we know we can get some water. We know we can get some, you know, potential passive energy through, like, water flow one way or its shape or the other. The next thing is shelter. We need shelter, and shelter needs a few very choice things. One, it needs to protect you against the environment. Now, the world's greatest shelter can only protect you so much. If you build in a floodplain and it floods, unless you happen to have built a boat.
Okay, Noah. But no, absolutely. The other thing I'm thinking about for location is, once again, depending on the reason we're bugging out, depends if I just decided I wanted to take a trip into the woods and this is where I live, versus something went down and I don't want to be found. That's going to decide where I go too, because if I don't want to be found, I'm not going to look for open areas, because assuming somebody still has a plane out there, that's going to pretty much, you know, spy you off really quickly. Versus if I'm just going into the woods because I've had enough of society, I really don't care if anybody sees me from above. You know what I mean? Maybe I want to stay a little bit more covered, but it becomes less of a problem than if I'm purposely trying not to be found.
Well, and there comes another factor I wanted to talk a little bit about. Assuming that I'm bugging out because I'm trying to avoid people, and for whatever reason, maybe I just don't want to see people anymore. Maybe I need the privacy. Maybe I'm, you know, whatever. I would choose somewhere that's at least a day's hike from people.
Yeah. Yeah, once again, depending on my situation, I get different feelings on this. Once again, depending on where and why I'm disappearing, I don't want it to be around houses. I'm not so concerned about it being too close to, like, a roadway or something. I want it to be far enough off, like, you know, at least a kilometer or two, but maybe not a day's hike off of a main road. But from people around me, like actual buildings and stuff like that, bare minimum, like at least 20, 30 kilometers. You know what I mean? That way your smoke, anything you're doing, your noise, stuff like that, it's not going to carry. It's not going to attract attention you don't want. It's going to give you a little bit of freedom. Now, that is a tricky thing to find somewhere that has nobody around it within, you know, 20, 30 kilometers. Ideally, that's what I would like. Now, Steve over here has his own ideas on what he would like for, you know, a bug out location. And frankly, if I could find this, this isn't a bug out location. This is where I'm moving. So he wants to go to an orchard surrounded by berry fields on the south side of a hill beside a nice river. I mean...
yeah, I mean, sure. But believe it or not, this is not as impossible as one might think. If you can find, for instance, maybe a place that used to be settled, that is no longer settled. So these communities exist out there where, you know, pear trees, apple trees, various other things have been planted. And then they were left to go to pot. And if you go back and find, you can sometimes clean those up and gain those resources.
Oh, for sure. You know, one of the places that I hunt on a yearly basis, that's exactly what it was. It was an old apple orchard. And orchard might be a stretch. We're not talking acres of apple trees here. But it was an old farm that had a lot of fruit trees there. There was crab apples, apples, choke cherries, you know, a bunch of stuff. And then the firm, I mean, for whatever reason, got sold, or the owners, you know, they might have died or whatever the case may be, but it just kind of wasted away, you know what I mean? But all the fruit trees are still there.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've seen stuff like this in the past. So, again, I'm looking for somewhere that I can build. So, again, if you have a hilly area, you don't want to set up probably right near the water. You don't want to set up at the ocean level because you can have issues. You want to be partway up, but not all the way to the top where the highest wind is. So I'm looking for a hilly area, close to rivers, ocean, and hopefully a lake not too far back and up, so they have access to a lot of stuff. Right now where I'm to, there's probably a lot of potential for this because it's very mountainous. So what I would personally be looking for is a hilly area. The advantage of that too is it means the terrain is generally difficult. So if I'm trying to avoid people finding me for whatever reason, let's assume that society has gone poorly and now we're just trying to survive, then having people happen upon to you very regularly could become a very big problem. And then you may end up getting crowded out or bothered. So being somewhere that's more secluded means that you'll have less interaction, less hassle in that way.
Keeping in mind, if trade is still, you know, on your mind, it's going to make that a little bit more difficult. But in my mind, I don't think about trade too often. I try to become very self-reliant. But once again, depending, maybe I got to work that into the occasion. So something that Dave here, Real Big Monkey One, said, good point, is you don't actually need a still to distill water. All you have to do is fill a pot with water, boil over fire, throw a towel over the top of it. Towel catches the steam, wring out drinkable water. I mean, you know what? This might actually make a good video. At some point, if I have a day, maybe I'll run down to the beach because it ain't far from here. And I'll try boiling up a big pot of water, see how much salt I get out of it. And I'll make, you know, a hillbilly distillery, which is just going to be a sheet of steel pitched over the top of it and see how much fresh water I get. Are you folks interested in that? That is something I'm willing to do because now I'm kind of interested as well.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. There's definitely a lot of options you can do. And I mean, it doesn't take a lot of resources to build some of this stuff or come up with that. But yeah, the towel idea is neat. I probably will try that Sunday just to see what it's like. I think it would take a little while to gain a ton of water that way.
Probably, but once again, depending on where you're at, if it's your only option, I'd be curious to see what's the most efficient way to get it. Because, I mean, you need so much water in the run of a day. I'm curious how much you would actually get out of it. You know what I mean? Like, time put in versus what you get out.
let's say you get one of those relatively absorbent cloths, and I'd say getting it initially wet would be the hardest part, but once it's damp, it would just fill again, and you wring it, you fill it. Just try not to burn yourself with the hotter steam water, but, you know, regularly going back and forth, I can see you getting a glass every 20 minutes, 15 minutes without too much effort.
Yeah, so Dave said it's a very slow process, but it works. And the only thing I'm wondering, and I think it would be fine, to make sure you're taking in more water than you're burning out. If you were getting a glass every 20 minutes, that's actually not bad. That's more water, depending on the season. If it's the dead center of summer and, you know, it's real hot and humid and you're sweating a ton, maybe not. But generally, a glass every 20 minutes, that's a pretty good supply of water coming in. It's a lot of effort. But, I mean, if you have a way to stockpile that water, I mean, every time I want to drink, I don't want to distill water. But if you have a way to store that, I mean, you could take a day when you get some of your other chores done, and you could bank up quite a bit of water over the course of however long you're out there.
You know, again, if you mention trade, if you do have access to the ocean, it does give you access to trade a bit better.
Yeah, because, I mean, well, depending if you got a boat or a raft, at least you have options. Most shorelines are going to lead to people somewhere without too much distance going.
Believe it or not, with a sailboat properly set up, you could be self-sufficient for a very long time. Some of those have water makers, so they can automatically distill the water using a small bit of electric power. You have a solar panel on it. You can fish a ton of food. And you can pull into the shore to get greens and stuff as you need it. You could go a long ways. But if you have a land point, I think you have a lot of other, you know, solid advantages of being able to.
And seeing we're kind of talking about food, we said we can get food out of the water and, you know, plant some vegetables and stuff like that. Ideally for me, because I am a hunter and stuff like that, I would like to find an area where there's potentially some game. You know what I mean? So it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be polluted with game, but hopefully there's enough that I might be able to harvest a deer or a few pheasants or a rabbit. And honestly, depending on why I'm out there again, comes down to if it's slower and tastier, it's probably on the menu at a certain point. So as long as there's something out there that you can get some proteins and irons and stuff out of, I mean, depending, I've eaten squirrel before. Squirrel tastes like turkey. It's just really chewy. I don't know about gray squirrels. Never been to the South, never eaten a gray squirrel, but a red squirrel, yeah, man, they taste like turkey. Funny story, me and same buddy, Marcus, we went out hunting, we were hunting pheasants, and we hadn't got anything all day. It just, we honestly weren't trying that hard, to be perfectly honest. We're stomping through the woods, talking back and forth. We're not the quietest hunters. We're just out for a day walk, honestly. The only thing we seen was a squirrel. And Mark literally said, is a squirrel edible? And I said, well, I've seen other people eat them. Let's harvest the squirrel. And I'm a big believer in anything that you dispatch, it has to be for a reason. You just don't kill something because you want to kill it. So I was like, all right, if you're going to dispatch it, we're going to eat it. Big thing to remember is most small mammals and critters and stuff like that, they're infested with fleas out in the wild. And this squirrel was no different. You know what I mean? There's a lot of fleas, a lot of stuff like that. So when you're cleaning this stuff, you have to be very careful to clean it well, or you have to scorch it. Keep that in mind, folks. Anyway, this thing's full of fleas. We eventually get it cleaned out. We get it home. I open dress it, which is incredibly hard to do with a small squirrel. I'm going to tell you that right now. But anyway, we got it home. Mel thought we were nuts. And we just fried it in a pan. We battered it, threw it in the pan, went to eat it. It tastes exactly like turkey. It's just really rubbery. But, I mean, you could eat it.
Oh, man. You can eat almost any meat. Just what effort is going to go into it? Is it worth the effort? And but yeah, to me, if you can get a large game occasionally, you're set. You're golden with that. A nice deer, moose, caribou, bear, any of these things. But you're also right. You have to be extremely careful of parasites, fleas, other things like that. So be very careful with that, and you know, make sure that you're cooking the meat thoroughly, you're taking care, and avoiding those pitfalls.
unpopular opinion here, I'm sure, for all of our carnivorous friends out there, but if you're going to eat venison and wild game, especially in the woods, get used to well-done meat. It's going to cause you a lot less problems. Yeah, maybe a little less flavorful, a little less juicy, but I can guarantee you way less intestinal parasites and sickness down the road. Also, you know, secret, not really a secret, in a survival situation or in a situation like we're talking about where we're trying to keep as many calories and stuff in as we can because food and stuff potentially could be limited, get used to stewing and boiling stuff because then you can drink the broth. And even if you boil up the bones and stuff like that, there's a lot of calcium that'll come out, a lot of other minerals and stuff you can get from that. You get a lot more out of it by boiling it and consuming everything that way than you do just by, say, cutting it off and roasting it. Roasting it does add another flavor, and I'm not saying that you have to boil everything, but definitely, like, your carcass or whatever you want to call it at the end of the day, you should boil that up. You know what I mean? And that was something we always used to do with on the farm. And I, once again, maybe unpopular opinion here, probably the wrong name, but what it was always called for us was head cheese. Do you know what I'm talking about already, Ben? So head cheese, yeah. Folks, is like when you harvest a goat or a cow or something like that, there's a lot of meat and stuff that remains in the cranium. And what people used to do was they would just simmer these things until all the meat came off and it was all scraped and it kind of became this paste. And it's still really popular to eat in places. It's called like head cheese and toast. You get it for a breakfast. It doesn't taste that bad. It's a little, you know, there's some plate fright involved in it because, oh my God, that was an animal's head and it got all boiled off. But the reality is it's still just edible meat. And there's a lot of good nutrients in it too.
Yeah. Have you heard that most bears have worms?
You know what? Trichinosis. I think that's what the name of it is. A lot of wild animals have trichinosis, which is just the worms that actually crawl in the muscle tissue. And, you know, I'm sure somebody out there is going to correct me, but I know when I was working for Natural Resources, it was a big thing with bears and moose. Also, brainworm was another big thing. So if you're, like, you can eat a brain. I'm going to tell you folks right now, it's not the most appetizing thing on the planet. It actually tastes... It's not the taste, it's the texture. It's like eating cartilage. There's a lot of cartilage in a brain, and it's not the most easy thing to consume. But anyway, yeah, you can get a lot of these parasites, and that's why you say you have to cook your meat very well. Like trichinosis, even tapeworm and stuff like that, if you cook it well, shouldn't be a problem. But I mean, it has to be cooked well. We're not talking, you know, your medium rares to medium wells here. We're talking well done. No pink. Juice running clear kind of deal. It has to reach a temperature of, I think most parasites, and once again, somebody's probably going to step in here. Most parasites and viruses and bacteria will die with a sustained temperature of 180 degrees Fahrenheit. Does that sound right, Ben? I mean, I'm pulling from memories that are at least 15 years old here.
No, that sounds a bit right. I mean, we could look it up, but yeah, agreed 100%. In this that environment, like you said, boiling it, cooking it thoroughly through, just makes sense. And it takes time to properly prepare meat. Like, there's a reason people used to smoke it. It's because you could quickly cut it up, strip it, you could put it under that heat, and that's going to keep flies and stuff off of it. It's going to dry it out, get rid of a lot of the risk. So that's another method. But again, if you think there's parasites or stuff in it and you've ingested those parasites, now the food you've gained, I mean, you've probably gained a little bit in the short term, but in the long term, your life is going to get significantly worse.
And I mean, not even parasites like worms, folks. It can be as simple as like just food poisoning in general out of something you've eaten, like salmonella. That's a bad one. You know what I mean? You can get that... fairly easily, depending on what you're consuming. And it's not fun. I mean, food poisoning in general is not fun. You're going to lose a lot of steam. You're not going to feel good while you're up walking around. And you're going to dehydrate fast, especially if you are, you know, if it's coming out both ends, which in most times it is with food poisoning. Generally, as fast as you're putting fluids in, they are coming out both ends of your body. And it gets into a real dangerous situation where you don't want to be dehydrated because you're already not feeling well, and now you don't get enough liquids into you, so you feel even worse, and then you start getting lethargic. You don't want to get up and make the water because you know you're just going to throw it up, and then you just, you know, that a lot of people have been really sick in the woods and have almost not made it over that exact thing. I think it's been mentioned on Alone. I don't normally name drop, but Les Shroud, Survivor Man, he did a year living in the woods, I think, with his wife, and they got really sick, and it caused them a lot of issues. Like, good people, famous people, you know, experts in their fields have been brought down by things as common as bad food.
So according to this, and this is for fish, 15 seconds at 145 degrees Fahrenheit.
Try venison. I know fish is it's a soft meat. It's a white meat. So it's not so bad. I think venison.
So the other thing they mention here is ginger, cayenne pepper, thyme, garlic, oregano, turmeric. Parsley. No, I don't know if I believe that. Let's leave that. Spicy foods, though. One of the reasons hot spices, especially in like third world countries, tended to be very popular is those spices, the capsaicin and stuff, that is hard on a lot of parasites, and that can help kill them off. So if you're in a position where you're worried, things like that, there's different chemicals, vinegars and stuff can oftentimes kill off some of this stuff, but temperature is still absolutely essential. I think this is something we're going to stick with. Do your research.
Yeah. We're not experts, folks. Please do your research. Don't say that you heard it on Atlantic Bushcraft Adventures that if you cook it well, you're never going to get sick. There's exceptions to every rule. Highly encourage to do your research for whatever's in your area and go with those guidelines. So moving on, we've talked about a little bit on location. We talked about water management. We talked about a little bit of food management. Where do you want to go from here, Ben?
So water, food, we've talked shelter. So I think we've talked a bit about like the environmental. I would look for more hilly terrain. There's a lot of reasons for that. For me, it means I can do some elevation distances. There should be relatively good wildlife and shelter. But you're also looking for a place with relatively mild seasons.
Yeah. Ideally, I would not be living on the east coast of Canada through the winter if I had to bug out and stay there. Could I do it? Maybe. Would I want to? No. Before we move on, I know Dave's with us. I actually picked up a product specifically with Dave in mind. As you folks may or may not know, Dave is an avid listener to Atlantic Bushcraft Adventures here. He hangs out in the comments all the time. He gives his insight. He is a wealth of information. If you haven't already, check out his YouTube channel, Real Big Monkey One on YouTube. Does a ton of good videos. He's from the south down there in Georgia, I believe, Dave. If you don't want to correct me there, I'm pretty sure it's Georgia or down around Georgia. But anyway, long story short, we were talking about Ranger bands, and he did an episode on Ranger bands. Which, honestly, Ranger bands to me has always been like inner tubes, and you just cut them into strips, and there's your Ranger bands. However, just because we had this conversation, and I seen these while we were out, check this sucker out. They're called tack bands, and these are just Ranger bands by another name, honestly. They are nothing more than just inner tubes in bags. But when I seen it, I was like, oh man, I know Dave built a shelter out of these things. I'm buying these with him in mind. I think I have a bag of these open here somewhere. Yeah, there's one.
Yeah.
See what I mean? They're literally just like strips of inner tube put in bags and then remarketed to people. And I paid something stupid for these too. I'm not going to lie. I think this bag was like $20 or something. You know what I mean? But anyway, I was thinking of you, Dave. I seen it, and I now own an entire bag of what is called Kaiser Wilderness Supply is the company, and it's TAC bands, tactical survival bands, a quarter pound of tactical rubber bands. I mean, anyway, sorry, we derailed off our actual topic, but I knew you were on here, Dave, and I've had these sitting on my desk ever since you did your episode, and I bought them. So there you go, buddy.
I'm not sure that's a horrible price.
I don't know. Well, once again, I'm old school, man. Inner tubes used to be free from the dump. You know what I mean? You just walk up to the local junkyard, find a bunch of scrap bicycles, pull the tires apart, grab the inner tubes, and run away. Tactical is better than good. Dave, I'm going to be honest with you, man. I seen these things, and I started roaring. And now I own them, so, I mean, maybe someday I will send you a couple.
So I just typed in on Amazon, Bicycle 2. And looks like you can pick up a 29-inch tire tube for about $644 on sale. It's 44% off. So each tube would cost you about $10 normally. I'm just in here, and it's generally the way rate it's going. So you know, you can probably get 20, maybe 30 bands out of a tube, maybe a few more.
And I don't know how many's in this. It doesn't give any kind of numbering system on them.
How many pounds you got?
Quarter pound is what it says on here.
Oh, yeah. So probably ballpark. You might have a bit. It's not horrible. You didn't do too bad.
I know I probably overpaid for them. Now I'm trying to find the website to see how, like, they do have a website written on them, but I don't think the website works anymore. I literally found this in just a supply shop when I was screwing around.
Yeah, it says this package of two tubes is a pound. So for $20. So. And you didn't have to cut it.
Well, there is that.
We know that we can't trust you with sharp objects.
Oh, man. That's how I lose fingers. All right, found the website. Where are these tactical bands at? I didn't buy them off this website. I'm just curious to see what they are worth off their own website. Anyway, I will come back to this. Let's get back on topic a little bit. So we're talking about location now, and you said you wanted to go to a hillier area. For me, I'm looking for a wooded area to go along with that, because the woods usually drags around some sort of wildlife. You know what I mean? Be it birds or mammals or whatever, even reptiles in a pinch. I'm not against eating a snake. Somebody once told me it tastes like frog legs, and frog legs to me taste like chicken with a little bit of fish. So I'm willing
everything
to try.
Tastes like chicken, buddy.
What's that?
Everything tastes like chicken.
You put enough salt on it, everything does taste like chicken.
But no, you have a good point. I also want, like I said, more environments that are somewhat available. You know, like I said, if there's boggy areas around, I'm pretty sure I can get cattails. Interesting note, I only found this out a little while ago. Bulrush, if you've ever been reading and said, oh, the bulrushes grow well there, that is what cattails are. They're the same. I did not know that.
Oh, you didn't know that? Oh, man, no, sorry, dude, I knew that. I thought bulrush, and I'm going to be honest, I've never heard them called cattails until I moved into town. They were always bulrush.
I never heard them called. Okay, anyways, cattail, everyone knows, is a great survival food. It offers an awful lot of stuff that you can get out of it. So I've heard the statement before that if you find cattails, you're saved. You're safe. You can get food. You can get a flour-like substance. You can get building material. You can weave it and make baskets and containers. And there's all kinds of stuff you can do with it. It is a great product. It is a great plant. It is very useful. If you get trees, like you said, the likelihood of game goes way up. You can start looking for snaring rabbits, squirrels, deer, and large game, you name it. And resources. Trees mean wood. And wood means you can build shelters, you can build fires, you can build all that stuff. So I think
that's it. It's just workable material.
Yeah. the more species, the better. Plus, things like funguses and other medicinal plants are more likely to be found in a diverse forested area, which means there's more food resources. I would probably try to plant a choice amount of vegetation, but for the most part, my goal would be to leave the land as natural as possible and scavenge what I can from what's natural.
But I mean, if you've got the woods around you, you can find a lot more dead wood. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I mean, found the tack bands. Sorry, just to jump off topic for 1 second. Off the website, they're $16.54 plus tax plus postage. So $20 was right around the ballpark. According to their website, there's approximately 50 to 60 bands in there, coming in three sizes, from 3.5 inches by 1/2 inch, 2.25 inches by 1/2 inch, and 3.25 inches by 1/4 inch. So several different sizes, approximately 50, 60 bands. Anyway, Dave, still thinking of you, buddy. I'm going to try and do something fun with these, and I'll send you a video.
Yeah, so are we missing anything? Water supply, shelter.
And funny enough, Steve made a comment on his perfect idea there. And he made a good point, and I'm hoping he made this on purpose. If not, I'm going to blow smoke up his butt anyway. But he said on the south side of a hill. So he even took aspect into idea on here. So here in our neck of the woods, folks, if you're not from Canada, the southern to southeast, southwest, that is probably the warmest place on a hill. That's where the sun comes up. It gets the most daylight. Things dry out a little better on that side. You're going to have a little bit more heat. If you're running solar panels, they always tell you to pitch them to the south, southeast side simply because they're going to catch more light. So Steve even took aspect into this, and I wasn't even thinking of that, to be perfectly honest.
No, it's a good point, especially if you're running solar panels or anything like that. You're going to get much more effectivity out of that. Like you said, it's warmer, more hours of sunlight. If you're on the north side, you know, certain times of year you'll get much less. You can be in that shadow. And if you're on east or west in the mornings or evenings, you're getting less, depending on. Yeah. Is there anything else, though? Food, shelter, resources. Those are the main things I'd be looking for.
And like I said, this is going to change depending on the reason that I'm bugging out. If I just decided I've had enough with society, which you and I have talked about quite honestly, probably more than the average person should. Yeah, I'd probably be a little bit more freer with where I went. I wouldn't be so worried about people coming around me or seeing me. I'd probably still be dipped off the beaten path, but it wouldn't be so much of a concern to me. Now, if society failed, or I was trying to get away from something, or I was trying not to be found, yeah, it's going to change a little bit. I'm going to go a lot deeper. I'm probably definitely going to head to more hilly terrains, because funny fact, if you want to call it a funny fact or whatever you want to call this, the hilly terrains also creates a lot of geothermals. So it's difficult for smaller planes to fly over these at low altitudes. A lot of plane crashes and stuff like that around the Alps and stuff, it's just because of the natural wind currents that come around these things. And yeah, like commercial jets and stuff, they obviously have no problem, but they're flying, you would know this better than I would, Ben, how a commercial jet, where they fly around 25,000 feet or something?
I'm not sure of the elevation.
Anyway, it's further away than they're going to see me with a pair of binoculars. I can tell you that much. Well, unless it's one hell of a pair of binoculars, I guess. But anyway, it's not the commercial planes or the jets or stuff like that I'd be really worried about. It's literally low-flying reconnaissance. So yeah, if I'm trying to hide, hilly areas are definitely going to come into that because the natural geothermals that happen through there because, you know, the cool air pools at the bottom, and then as it warms up, it throws up, and it just makes all this, you know, turbulence for planes. And a lot of small planes just don't want to deal with that nonsense. It's hard for them. They can't keep a constant course. So you're kind of coming into a little protection with that as well.
I Googled it for you quickly. The average commercial airplane is between 33,000 and 42,000 feet.
Well, there we go. I was at 25,000. I was still way under it. Commercial was way up, 30, 40,000 feet. Thanks, Steve. He was doing the same thing, I think. But yeah, I mean, that's not the kind of stuff that I'm going to worry is going to spy me out down there. You know what I mean? They're not looking for a little old me. Hopefully, they're not looking for a little old me and, you know, needle in a haystack kind of deal. You're going to get a lot of low-flying aircraft for that stuff. It's going to be smaller jets, smaller reconnaissance planes, things like that are definitely going to get affected by that turbulence caused by mountainous areas. So if hiding was a fact, or a factor more specifically, definitely going to head towards the hillier areas.
The thing to keep in mind, too, is if somebody has the resources to have a plane, your meager resources are probably not on their interest level.
No, I'm thinking more like tyrannical? Tyrant? What's the word I'm looking for here? Tyrant.
Tyrannia? Tyrants? Yeah.
Anyway, a government that's basically went sideways and off their hinges. You know what I mean?
So. Yeah. No, I know what you mean. I mean, that's another reason. Like, the more difficult the terrain is to navigate, the less likely someone's going to put the time or resources to get to you. So
exactly,
if you're on a nice flat plane, they can probably drive up to you. If you're in a hilly, mountainous terrain, and this is one of the things that we did a survival exercise one time. It was a mind one. It wasn't physically you had to do it. But the example they gave was crashing in the mountains here in BC. And the thing is, if you crash in the mountains in BC, it can actually be almost impossible to walk out. If you crash in Nova Scotia or Newfoundland, chances are Long Range Mountains in Newfoundland might be an exception, and so could parts of the Highlands. But for the rest of it, you're going to be able to walk out. You're going to be able to walk to the coast, walk across land. You might have to climb a little bit, but it's going to be reasonable. Other places where we have extremely steep highland cliffs, it means that you can't get a motorcycle, a bicycle, or even in some instances, a plane reasonably into it. So now you're down to things like helicopters or extremely specialized aircraft, making that difficult. Or maybe the only way to get to it is by boat, but again, somewhat limited. So more resources people have to put into it, the less likely you are going to be to accidentally found or your resources be taken away from you. So if you can get away, if society went sideways today, most people are going to stick in the cities for a while. And then when they leave, they're going to go in mass, the paths of least resistance. They're going to go out highways. They're going to go immediately to probably boats and stick to close coastlines. They're not going to go super far because they don't know what to do or where to go. Those that do will have a better plan. And honestly, you don't want to mess with those guys either. So if you have a plan and you have a place to go, take advantage of that and go to it. If you don't, you know, you're going to end up doing with the masses. I don't think. But.
Oh, Steve, Ben, that cabin we went to would be a nice spot. Not that I could make it back there again. That was your guys' boating trip.
Yeah, it meets a lot of those criteria, though. We had steep land on either side. There were spots we were already a couple hundred feet above that cabin in one spot. I say a couple hundred, probably 100, 150 anyways. It wasn't easy to get to. It took a lot of effort. People could know about it, but anyone going to it is taking an effort and probably not coming with a ton of people. And if they are, they have a very good reason to do that. So it meets those criteria. There was a couple of lakes within a day's trip, easy. I mean, we managed to get to it from the airport in about a day, but it took us a day to get there. So that's a good example of that. Something like that would work. The only disadvantage, and it's a minor one, is it would take time to get to a saltwater. So if you wanted the saltwater resources, that's not going to be there. But if you look at the world population, most humans live within so many kilometers, it's not a lot, of the ocean.
Yep. No, for sure. I mean, the ocean covers 70% of the planet, right? So,
yeah,
something like that. My math.
The biggest populations, the biggest cities are not in the central area of the country. And even those that are often connected by large waterways. So even Winnipeg, you go back to like the Assiniboine and Red River and the Great Lakes. That's how we got back to these places. Places like, thinking Calgary and Edmonton are a bit of an exception.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, I thought it was weird. I actually met somebody that never seen the ocean. I'm like, what do you mean you've never seen the ocean? You know what I mean? So people like that do exist out there, and it's kind of weird. But the reality is the vast majority of people, they're not that far from the ocean.
No, they aren't. Maybe a
Predators episode in the future could be interesting. All right, Steve. I was just reading the comments there. So Steve said maybe a Preppers episode in the future could be interesting. Just for curiosity's sake, Steve, what would you like us to cover on a prepping episode, to be honest with you? Because, I mean, Ben and I, we openly admit we're not really big preppers. We're, you know, we're kind of bushcrafters more so, and therefore, I mean, I do carry a bug-out bag, so semi-sorta. Not a bug-out bag like you would consider a bug-out bag, like, oh, I'm going to grab this and take off. It's going to be like a bag I throw in the back of the truck, and if something happens, I have enough stuff with me that I can spend a night comfortably wherever I am. I guess that's a prep bag more than a bug-out bag. I'm not sure. Are there any small islands off the coast of Nova Scotia raft out to one and live there? So small islands off the coast, yes. There is tons. Actually tons of them here in Nova Scotia. If you go, what was the TV show? Dual Survival. Very first episode of Dual Survival was on a small island off Labrador, I think, which is not Nova Scotia, but I mean, Nova Scotia, Newfoundland, Labrador, PEI, we're all really close together. What's that?
They did one off Nova Scotia.
Was it off Nova Scotia or Labrador? The first episode is somewhere.
Pretty sure it was Nova Scotia. Okay. Newfoundland has a bunch too, but and some of them more livable than others. But Mahone Bay, I think they estimated there was about 360-something. The number I was told was 365. I don't think that's an accurate number. I think there's more or less, but it was just a round number. Islands in the Bay of Mahone Bay.
That makes sense. You know where would be a great place to go? Kinda. Sable Island, because it's already set up to be self-sustaining. And folks, don't go to Sable Island. Sable Island's a protected island. It is off the coast of Nova Scotia. It's very protected. People are not going to be happy if you try and blow in there. They're actually get really upset about it because it's a protected. It's not a park. It's an actual protected island because of the Sable Island horses, as well as there's a lot of other natural and ecological things that happen on that island. I think there's only like, what, 10 people that stay on that island at any given time to run the research facility.
There's a limited amount of visitation allowed now.
Yeah, I know, but it's very limited visitation if you read into it. You basically get off at the research center and pff, off you go. Really available meat and glue.
But that's also an island, if I remember correctly, there's not much in the way of forest. It's sandy.
No, it is a very open island. That is the problem. And that is a good point. There's not a lot of resources on this island. It is a big island. I mean, you'd have the horses, I guess, and open fields. And as Steve said, readily available meat and glue, but not a lot on the lines of vegetation. The other problem is that island gets hammered by high winds quite frequently, in all honesty. You know what I mean? Because it is out on the east coast of Canada, just barren. And a lot of the storm fronts and stuff come up that kind of channel or the St. Lawrence Strait, and they just, it gets wrecked. It's built to withstand it, but I mean, somebody out there in a tent, you're going to have a bad day when hurricane season rolls through.
100%. Anyways, I think we've gone quite a ways.
Yes, we did. We went quite a ways on this. It was an hour. I didn't expect to take an hour on this. I knew we could. I was trying to keep it condensed, and I think we still condensed it and still got our hour. So.
Anyways, you know, something to think about when you're out hiking and stuff. Look at it and say, would this be a place that could work? It's an interesting thought experiment, if nothing else. Sometimes when I'm out and I see a spot, I wonder, like, could I survive here for an extended period of time? And would this make a good location? Most of the places I go are regular hiking trails and more visited and would not make a great reason for various reasons. But environmentally, they do set up the right ideas.
Yeah, and I actually have a two bug out locations in mind that Mel and I have always joked about. If anything happens, we're heading there. And are they perfect? No. But are they quick and easily accessible and out of the way? Yes. So they'd more realistically be a temporary base of operations until we figure out our long-term permanent plan. But there's an island off the coast of Georgia called Osaba Island. Hopefully I got that right, Dave. Years ago, they dropped Russian boars on that island, and they have taken over a lifetime supply of ham, bacon, and sausage, providing they don't kill you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there's definitely a risk there.
Oh, actually, as I'm sitting here talking about it, I have my GPS. Pretty sure I still got the coordinates for both of those places in here. That's how prepared I am. I've thrown them on a GPS. Anyway, yeah, we have come up to our 1 hour, or are coming up to our 1 hour. I think we've talked about this at great length. I imagine we could probably continue talking about it at great length, but probably as good a place as any to kind of leave it for tonight.
Yeah, I think so.
All right, folks. So for me, my final thoughts are, same as always, I leave you with a question. What would you look for in a location if you were bugging out? What's important to you? What is, you know, what would you look for? Ben and I talked about our thoughts and opinions, but that's all they are, is thoughts and opinions. What would you folks look for? Be sure to shoot us a message, join us on Facebook, YouTube, all of those things. Or you can contact us off our website, which is down here somewhere, atlanticbushcraft.ca. There's a contact us thing on there. Let us know what you guys would do. I mean, I'm always interested when I hear feedback from you folks, and we do get some where they message in, some will email us. We have had comments on our YouTube channels and things like that. And yes, I do read them all. And I know I relay most of it over to Ben as well, and I'm sure he goes through and looks at most of them too. Just so happens to be that, you know, neither of us are super technologically advanced, and we struggle with it a little bit, but we do get around to it, I promise.
100%. Very good. Okay. Thanks for everyone for listening. Get out there. Have fun. Enjoy yourselves. And like Robert said, let us know, you know, what your thoughts are.
Have a good night, everybody. We'll see you next week.